Now, history is littered with theories that were utterly wrong, statements the society once thought were unequivocally true until bold innovators challenged the status quo. Now, in economics, that disruptor is John Quiggin, University of Queensland economics professor. He's discovered patterns and predicted outcomes that mainstream economics initially rebuked until a decade later when long-term studies proved him right. Now, his latest project is upending and demolishing the economic belief espoused in Henry Hazlitt's 1946 book, Economics in One Lesson. And that was that market prices reflect the full opportunity cost. Now, following up his own book about zombie economics, he's got Economics in Two Lessons, where John uncovers why economics cannot be understood in one lesson and schools on how markets actually work. We've got John Quiggin on the line from Queensland. We're going to talk about how to predict economic trends and about his book. G'day, John.
G'day.
Thanks for joining us on 2SER this afternoon. Congratulations on the release of the book.
Thank you.
Is it always a bit of a risk naming a book after a well-known existing book about economics?
Good question. The original title for Zombie Economics was a pun on the title of another book, and we decided not to go that way. In this case, it seems to have worked. We'll just have to see. I mean, so far, books attracted favourable attention, so we'll just have to see. See how it goes, I guess. The other book sold a million copies, so I guess if I can sell a tiny fraction of those, we'll be very happy.
We'll be happy. Well, what made you question the economic arguments that were made in the 1946 book?
It's a very simple-minded version of mainstream economics, and a version that has waxed and waned in terms of popularity. We've seen over the history of economics periods when very simplistic versions have been popular, most recently, I guess, in the 1990s, when people were very much falling all over themselves to say how great markets were, and periods of questioning, like Keynes in the Great Depression. And so what I wanted to do, I guess, was give a full picture, first explaining, I guess, why these arguments can't just be dismissed out of hand. There's a lot of truth in the idea that that market prices are important and that in important cases leaving things to markets is a good idea, but equally why it's important not to go overboard with that, why it's important for governments to play a central role in the economy also.
Indeed, and economics is one of those things that I feel people either love and know all about or are scared of. You know, they don't really want to, and they'll leave it to the mainstream media to educate them on what they should be knowing. Do you find that as well?
I do, and I think, I mean, there's several different problems. One is that what you see on the mainstream media most of the time really isn't economics at all. It's looking at a few markets which are of interest to people trading in those markets. Roughly speaking, what economics can tell us is something like what Norman May used to say about the cricket, that these markets can go up, down, or stay the same. After the fact, you can make a story up about it. No one can really predict these things with any accuracy, but they need a talking head to talk about it. So that's fairly useless. The other problem is that most of what's taught in economics courses is necessary if you're going to become a professional economist, but not really that useful to you if what you want to do is understand, for example, whether the government should be involved in providing healthcare or not. There's a lot of technical work about trying to work out if you raise a particular tax rate, how much revenue you bring in. You need a complicated economic theory for that. You don't need it to understand the kind of debate that I'm having with Hazlitt, which is really all about when prices give the right signals and when they don't.
And the interesting point you make is quite often, if you look at it from one point of view, a decision might be good economically, you know, and that's what we see a lot in these sort of election campaigns. They look like they're a good idea on paper, but then there's often another side to it. There's a result to that economic decision that you make that people don't necessarily see. Is that why you've sort of expanded it to the two lessons?
That's right. I mean, of course, it's also true that often, indeed, Hazlitt's taking off a book called What Is Seen Is What Is Not Seen. It's not true that all the economic costs and benefits of a decision are obvious. And so if you say, well, the government should, for example, provide something for free, there's an opportunity cost, which is something else that couldn't be provided. And so you have to say, well, this is the best thing we could be doing with public funds. And so that lesson applies in both parts of the book, that you need to look at at all of the costs of what we're doing. And we see that, I guess, with the climate change debate, that we're having from the current government a lot of noise about how much it would cost to do something about climate change, but of course nothing about the costs of doing nothing about climate change.
And that's it. It's a really divisive issue in terms of, you know, economy versus climate change. Some people seem to think that they're mutually exclusive and that you can't do one or have a good economy whilst fighting climate change. But I love that you rebuked that in some articles I've seen recently. But just quickly, I wanted to ask, this book was written over 8 years, yeah, I believe, and you released chapters bit by bit, trying to get feedback on them before it was officially published. Why did you choose this method, and how much did that change the final outcome of the book?
A good question. I did that also with zombie economics, though it didn't take as long.
Okay.
This book was very hard to do. I think it's, as I say, I'm trying to reach a broad audience, not professional economists, although some of my professional economist friends have been very kind about the book, but also not to oversimplify and talk down to people. So what I'm trying to do is give the whole argument as best I can, but in a way that ordinary people with an interest in policy can understand. And so by putting it up in this way, I've tried to do that. I've tried to organise the book, avoid things like endnotes, which are sort of used in the sort of half-academic books, which I find terrible, and tried to make the book more readable in that way. So everything's been focused on trying to reach an intelligent audience, but one that doesn't have economics training.
Sure. And like Roger Backhouse, author of Ordinary Businesses of Life, has said here, people often try to write for readers who know no economics, but they rarely succeed. And he says this book is the exception. So that's some nice praise.
Well, it was a nice tribute, because that's exactly the aim, and that's why putting it out putting it out for people to look at, and if they say, look, this makes no sense to me, I say, well, obviously I have to. It seemed obvious to me, but obviously I need to go back and have another go at it.
Now, we've seen the media loves to latch on to the buzzwords. You know, it's a lot of the time it's about the deficit, or it's about the surplus. You know, it's about good and bad economic management, which seems to be this misconception, I believe, that Labor are bad economic managers and Liberal are good. I've never seen anything to actually prove this, but what do you think of this sort of divisive method that mainstream media uses?
I talk more about this, I guess, in zombie economics than in the current book, which is less topical. I mean, I think this, I mean, the first point, which I mean, we really see in the current election campaign, it is just that most commentators we have are basically sports commentators. There was a piece in one of the papers saying, the big problem is that neither leader's managed to land a killer blow on the other one. And so the way they think of politics is a sort of team sport with two captains who lead the fight. And the policies are really just counters, in some sense, that move back and forth without any real concern as to whether there's any truth or validity. So if it's generally accepted that deficits are bad and surpluses are good, then that goes in as a sort of scoring opportunity in the game. So there's no real discussion about these things, whereas this really is an issue where one group of economists came in and say, well, budget deficits and surpluses are a management tool. We should run deficits at certain times and surpluses at other, versus the one lesson view, which is roughly the government should balance the books all the time. So that kind of underlying dispute never gets raised. Instead, the journalists essentially just all agree for a while that deficits are bad. I think 6 years in which, or 10 years really under governments of both colours, where they've all said there'll be a surplus real soon now, there's been no surplus and the sky hasn't fallen in, has kind of taken the edge off that.
Yeah, I guess it has. And I feel like people are starting to realise that both parties, are just doing what they can to obviously keep the economy going, but spending money as well.
Yeah.
The current crop of politicians that we have, I don't think anyone really stands up as a great economist in the lot. I mean, I look at Paul Keating's been in the news a bit lately, and he was well known as quite an astute economics,
I have to say, from my perspective, I mean, Paul Keating, who's an incredibly bright man, was nonetheless essentially a one-lesson kind of economist. He didn't really understand well the case for government intervention. So I would actually say, compared to previous corpus, although there's no particular person of outstanding talent and communication, Labor's policy position is much more like the one I would recommend than either party has put forward in a very long time. Mm. So we are indeed seeing a reasonably sharp divide in policy between the parties, which is historically very unusual. And it's unfortunate that essentially political journalists are incapable of telling a story like that. So it has to be, you know, who said what about whose mother and so forth.
Oh, yeah, we saw that in the news today. On a side note, in a recent article in The Guardian, you've mentioned that you don't think the Adani Carmichael mine will actually go ahead at all. Of course, we've seen mostly approvals so far, but it's still got a couple of hurdles to go. And obviously, the election is a big hurdle. What's the key point there? I mean, obviously, a lot of people are against the Adani mine.
I think the key point is economics. Ultimately, there's lots of opposition to it, which has slowed the project down. But, I think if the project had the kind of profitability that it seemed to have 8 years ago, given the availability, given a supportive federal government and so forth, Adani would have taken the action to push it through, which would involve spending a lot of its own money getting started on things, which they could easily have done even without the final approvals. Really, the project doesn't stand up economically, and the result is that essentially both sides are shadowboxing to a large extent. Adani sort of keeps it on life support, every now and then makes a press release or sends 20 people out to the site and says we're all set to go. Meanwhile, I think particularly the Labor Party is waiting, hoping that the project will fall over its own accord so that they don't get the blame for killing it.
Yeah, they're very non-committal to the
mine.
I mean,
there's two reasons for that. One is the political flak, but the other is that we had a free trade agreement with India, and even though that agreement has lapsed, we're still liable under these terrible investor state dispute settlement clauses to be sued by a foreign corporation like Adani for things which an Australian corporation wouldn't be able to sue for. So the government has to tread very carefully to avoid being sued, and I think that explains Labor's reluctance to come out explicitly against the mine.
Well, very interesting. People can read your articles up on The Guardian, and of course you write and the blog. Sorry, I've forgotten the blog's name.
JohnQuiggan.com.
JohnQuiggan.com, of course. And, people can read your articles there and find your book, Economics in Two Lessons, Why Markets Work So Well and Why They Can Fail So Badly. You can find that in all good bookstores, I'm sure. John, thank you so much for joining us on 2SER. It should be interesting to see what happens in a week or two.
It should be.
Okay. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye.
Bye. John Quiggan right there. He chatting about economics in two lessons, his book. It's quite an interesting topic and sounds like a book that you can read if you're sort of interested in economics but not quite, you know, a professor in it. So look that up in your bookshop and you might learn something.